Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, my name is Svetlana Tomic, and I will moderate this podcast today. My guest today will be Dr. Veronica Cabreira. She is a neurologist originating from Portuguese, where she finished the medical school in 2016. And she right now living in Edinburgh, where she is preparing her PhD thesis in the field of functional cognitive impairment. So I think she is the perfect guest for our podcast. Welcome, Veronica.
Thank you, Svetlana. It's an honor, and thank you to you and for the EAN for inviting me for this podcast. It's really an honor.
Functional cognitive impairment is a very intriguing theme, and we are aware of a lot of functional neurological impairment, and I think this is the youth field of functional impairment in neurology. So could you, for the start, explain the definition and tell us something in global, what is a functional cognitive impairment?
Yeah, okay, so that is a very important question. So functional cognitive disorder is the cognitive subtype of a functional neurological disorder, which, as you said, is a very trendy and important topic nowadays in neurology, not only in clinical settings, but also in research. So this usually happens when the patients have an inability to voluntarily access their cognitive functions, even though they are automatically preserved. So, for example, we usually see in the clinic that patients show symptoms that are due to concentration and attention impairment more than in their memory. So, for instance, common symptoms are misplacing items, losing track during conversations or while they are doing a task. For example, forgetting overlearned information such as PIN numbers or names of people they know, word finding difficulties that is called the tip of the tongue phenomena. So they know the words they want to say, but the words momentarily don't come out. Going blank, for example, feeling mentally fatigued. So these are some of the common symptoms. And why is this so important to talk about and why we are doing research in this area as well? It's because it is a very, very common issue. And anyone, as you know, Svetlana, that does memory clinics knows that a lot of patients that attend the clinic, especially specialized memory settings, have functional cognitive symptoms. We estimate that around a quarter to a third of the patients attending the memory clinic have what we call nowadays a functional cognitive disorder. And we have as well epidemiological data from memory clinics that actually show surprising data because even though the dementia prevalence is increasing worldwide, we know that the proportion of patients attending the memory clinic that actually have a diagnosis of dementia is decreasing. So for some reasons, but probably, for example, because there is an increased awareness of dementia, and now there is this boom and this news around the new disease-modifying therapies for Alzheimer's disease, for example, more people are attending memory clinics because they are concerned about their memory. And because of this, so a group of researchers around 2020, they decided to unify the diagnosis criteria. Currently, we define functional cognitive disorder as first, so patients presenting with one or more cognitive symptoms that are due to impairment in attention or concentration. Then often these symptoms have to be very distressing and disabling, for example, interfering with occupational domains, social domains, and work abilities as well. They have a core characteristic that is what we call internal inconsistency. And just to clarify, so internal inconsistency is a discrepancy between the subjective self-reported cognitive difficulties and the objective level of functioning. So we can usually objectify the level of functioning, for example, by the conversational abilities of the patient, by their level of functioning on a daily basis. For example, they remain able to work without difficulties, to carry on doing their financial financial tasks, so they care about everything at home. And this discrepancy is what we call internal inconsistency, and we can see these by a detailed clinical history. So it is important to say that the diagnosis is clinical. And the last criteria is these cognitive symptoms cannot be explained by another medical or psychiatric condition.
So as I know, this is similar to the other neurological functional disorders. The diagnosis is based maybe more on positive clinical symptoms and signs than excluding our other reasons. Is it right here?
Yeah. So in terms of the diagnosis, so first of all, what I usually do is I try to think, why is it that this patient in front of me has memory symptoms? And after that, so I try to do, as for any neurological condition, a detailed history, so clinical history, and then I try to identify if the pattern that I have in front of me is consistent with any condition that I know. So usually, as I was saying, it is important to identify problems that are essentially in attention and concentration, as I say. So if the patients have other symptoms, for example, in personality or behavioral changes or navigation issues, that would point me in another direction, for example, Alzheimer's disease or frontotemporal dementia. So I try to identify this pattern that is congruent with functional cognitive disorder and the internal inconsistency I was talking about. So for instance, in the clinic, the typical cases are, for example, someone that complains about terrible issues with the memory or recall, but then they are able to function independently, continue to work without difficulties, and they are able to describe to you in detail examples of situations when their memory let themselves down. So they, for example, will say, last week I was putting fuel in my car and then I forgot to take the keys out, or I was trying to call someone and I could not remember their names, but they are able to tell you everything in detail of what happened in that situation. And we would not expect this from someone with a dementia and short-term memory impairment. Another example, for example, is someone that describes difficulties with numbers and PIN numbers, but then this person is still able to manage their finances and pay their mortgage and all that. So this is another example of internal inconsistency. And then I usually try to identify using, for example, a biopsychosocial module, I try to identify if the characteristics of the patient in front of me are congruent with this hypothesis that I have in terms of diagnosis. So we know, for example, that having certain characteristics in terms of personality, a tendency to memory perfectionism, setting really high standards for our memory that are not compatible with, for example, experiencing memory lapses on a daily basis, having a tendency for more obsessive compulsive disorder or obsessive ways of thinking, or even just having a huge cognitive overload. So being completely overloaded with tasks to do, not sleeping well, being affected by pain, fatigue, having stress in life. So all these things obviously will predispose us to have memory symptoms. And then we know that in some people that perhaps are more predisposed, they can have precipitating factors that then lead to these memory symptoms. So for instance, someone that then goes through a surgery or has a flu, for example, COVID, or goes through a very difficult period in life, going through a divorce, having been involved in a car accident, having a mild traumatic brain injury. So all of these things will predispose to memory symptoms. And there is an interesting characteristic we are now studying, that is, we also seem to see in the clinic a higher prevalence of memory symptoms that are functional in nature in people that have family history of dementia. But usually these family history are, for example, just one individual affected at an older age. So usually onset of memory symptoms in their 70s and 80s. But being exposed to these memory symptoms in a daily life, for example, caring, being a carer for someone with these issues, might as well influence our illness beliefs of what is having a dementia. So next time I experience memory lapses, maybe my brain will automatically predict that I'm having a dementia as well. And then often, so these people tend to, as I say, They tend to be very perfectionists, so they set really high standards for their memory. And we know that this is often linked to success. So, for example, doctors and other people working in high demanding jobs tend to be quite perfectionists. So the next time that they experience memory lapses, they will start monitoring their memory more closely. They start being more alert and vigilant for these symptoms. And of course, we know that if we are monitoring our symptoms very closely, there is a tendency to notice them more often. This is, for example, the same I often explain to the patients. If we buy a car of a certain make or a certain brand, next time we are on the road, it seems like all the cars are like our car. They are all the same. But this is a bias, obviously. It doesn't mean that more people are buying the same car. So when people notice these memory symptoms more frequently, what happens is that this increases anxiety, this increases anticipation of more failures, and this can drive a lot of frustration next time that they experience more memory lapses. And over time, unfortunately, some people go on to develop what we call counterproductive illness beliefs. So they start believing that there is a cause for their symptoms, often a dementia. And they also develop illness beliefs regarding the prognosis. So they start believing that they will never get better. They will never be able to overcome this situation. They cannot do certain things. And some of them even start avoiding situations. So, for example, they disengage from hobbies. They might delegate responsibilities. They start checking everything they do very closely. They do a lot of lists. They write everything in calendars. They write a lot of reminders in their phone and so on. So obviously, this leads to less tolerance for memory symptoms. And all of this takes a lot of space in our brain. So naturally, we just start experiencing more memory lapses because the attention is being impaired. So I go through all these features in the clinical history to try to confirm my diagnosis. And then just to conclude, I think it is important as a second step, I always try to look for comorbidities as well, because we know that some of these people either primarily or secondarily can experience, for example, mood disorders, anxiety disorders. It is very common as well to have functional cognitive symptoms as a feature of other somatic and functional disorders. For example, people with chronic pain and chronic fatigue, other functional neurological disorders also commonly experience what they call brain fog. Sleep disorders as well. It is very important in a diagnosis to try to screen for sleep disorders. So obstructive sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome. Of course, if they are present, they can impair their memory. So it is important to treat. And then as well, medications. We know that sedatives, benzodiazepines, antihistaminic drugs, opioids, they can all affect the memory, anticholinergic drugs as well. And finally, screening for vascular risk factors that I would do in any patient in the clinic. And then in terms of investigations, we get that question a lot. I wouldn't say that investigations are an essential part in functional cognitive disorders. So if we are going to do it, we have to have in mind that these patients have a higher tendency to experience anxiety. So I will often always do a blood screening for reversible causes of cognitive symptoms. And then if I usually do any imaging method, for example, a CT scan or a brain MRI scan, I explain to the patients that there is a high chance of having incidental findings. And for example, having white matter changes or a mild global atrophy, it is a bit like just having gray hairs, so it doesn't really impact on their function or change the diagnosis here. I also try to explain that we can have a normal brain scan both in functional cognitive disorders and in neurodegenerative conditions, especially in an early stage. Alzheimer's disease can have a normal brain scan. And sometimes we might do a bedside screening cognitive test. I don't know if you do as well, Svetlana, but I think in terms of the bedside cognitive tests, what is more relevant here is more the emotional and behavioral response that the patient demonstrates. For example, being very anxious about the test or failing the easier parts of the test, but then being able to succeed in the most complicated parts of the test. giving approximate answers and making a lot of self-critical comments during the test, for example, saying that they are not performing well even though their performance is good, and so on. And I think in some cases, we just have to acknowledge our uncertainty about the diagnosis. So sometimes we are not able on a first appointment to make a clear diagnosis. And in those cases, we might need just longitudinal follow-up. And this is the key to establish the definitive diagnosis. And I'll be very cautious, for example, in making a diagnosis of functional cognitive disorder in someone that is presenting at an older age, for example, especially after 65. I'll be really cautious and I will at least schedule another follow-up to see if the situation changes.
Okay, and what are probably differential diagnoses that we can have in patients that present with functional cognitive impairment?
Yeah, so as I was saying, so I, based on the clinical history, I try to identify the key features of functional cognitive disorder. So it is important to say, and I did not refer before, that functional cognitive disorder should not be a diagnosis of exclusion. So I would only make this diagnosis if I have the typical features. So the internal inconsistency we were talking about, and the fear avoidance, the negative thoughts. So all the whole pattern together pointing in this direction. And as I was saying, for example, red flags for neurodegenerative conditions will be, for example, a patient that gives very short answers in the clinic, less details or very concrete answers would point more to a dementia, for example. A patient that comes with someone to the clinic instead of attending alone and looks for the accompanying person looking for help and while answering my answers during the clinical interview. For example, someone that presents with a slow decline initially and then keeps progressing over time. Someone that lacks insight, so it's not aware of the difficulties. And as I was saying as well, if during my clinical interview and neurological examination, I identify any praxis difficulties or visual spatial difficulties, navigation issues, such as getting lost, difficulties driving, this will point me into probably more a posterior, a typical form of Alzheimer's disease that we know can have a younger onset. And any marked personality and behavior changes, for example, would point to a frontotemporal dementia. And obviously, any changes in neurological examination, such as having Parkinsonism, will point to Lewy body dementia and so on. But I think the key message here to retain is that we should never make a diagnosis of functional cognitive disorder based on normal investigations.
Okay. And what about treatment? Can we help these people?
Yeah, so that is the field that we are dedicating more time now. So there are still a few things that we need to improve in the field. So even before treatment, I think one key feature is trying to improve the diagnosis of these patients. So definitely we need more positive features, as you were alluding to. We need more diagnostic features that allow us to make a reliable diagnosis. And I know that there are a few groups, for example, looking at phonetic and acoustic features in the speech of these patients with machine learning methods to try to distinguish these patients from those with dementia more accurately. And we also need more information regarding prognostic features, because we know that some of these patients, some of them remain stable over time, others will probably revert and resolve their symptoms over time, while others keep progressing. So we need to find out exactly what are the prognostic factors that determine those who will progress over time. But in terms of the treatment per se, so as for the diagnosis, the first step that I would do would be to explain why I'm making this diagnosis. So we don't have to act weirdly, we just have to explain clearly. This is a pattern of diagnosis, that this is a common problem. I often explain this is a common issue. I see this every day in the clinic. this pattern is familiar to me. So this is very important because this will basically end what we call the doctor shopping. Often these patients have already seen a lot of different doctors over time, and they will come very anxious about their symptoms. So if we as doctors are able to tell them, well, I think you have a functional cognitive disorder, and these are the reasons why I'm making this diagnosis, and then I make my formulation, I think you are having this diagnosis because X, Y, and Z, you have these risk factors and so on. This increases the confidence of the patients in the diagnosis. While still sometimes I'm not sure, and I still acknowledge that uncertainty to the patients. But even if there are other comorbidities, we can, if we identify a functional component, we can identify then treatment avenues. So in terms of evidence for specific treatment of functional cognitive symptoms, we don't have many studies. I know that there is a meta-analysis from 2018 that shows that, for example, we do not have any pharmacological options for these patients. Multivitamin drugs are not very important here. Probably it is more important to reduce medications that are impacting in cognition. As I said before, sedatives, opioids, anticholinergics should be reduced or stopped if possible. We know that memory training and cognitive rehabilitation probably are not very useful in this specific population. They did not demonstrate benefits neither for subjective or objective measures of cognitive function. And on the other hand, we know that, for example, treatments such as cognitive restructuring or cognitive behavioral therapy, expectancy changes, stimulating more flexible standards about their cognition. So patients knowing that it is normal to forget things sometime, how the memory works, maybe explain to them that they do not have problems with their memory per se, but it's more of a problem with the attention and having a lot of distractions, having a lot of factors impacting on their attentional reserves. So this is the first step that I try to do with my patients. So explain to them why the symptoms are appearing and what we can do about them. And this often makes them do the first steps for behavioral change. So gradually they can take steps to start avoiding things, to rely less on lists, for example, instead of writing everything in the calendars, they should give their brain opportunities to start working again slowly and test if things are improving or not. And hopefully we now have some trials going on at the moment. We have one trial in London that is testing group therapy on Zoom that is based on acceptance and commitment therapy for these patients. And there is a workbook being developed in the United States that I'm involved as well, that is also based in acceptance and commitment therapy with some techniques of mindfulness and thought reappraisal. And this workbook will be tested in a clinical trial very soon as well. And here in Edinburgh, so as part of my PhD, I'm now doing a trial in patients with functional cognitive disorder that will be using self-help digital therapy, so a mobile app. And they will be using this app, and it's based on cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness techniques as well. And just as a final line, I would say that speech and language therapists can also sometimes be very helpful for patients with word-finding difficulties. Occupational therapy and our neuropsychology colleagues can be very helpful as well. The problem is that we know that the resources are limited and these treatments can be expensive. So we do not have one neuropsychologist for each patient we see. And that's why we need to find some remote therapies as well.
Okay. As I understand, the first step is that patient understand and accept the diagnosis. So we have to explain them why and how we diagnose the functional cognitive impairment. After that, this is already start with the treatment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that is the first step to start the treatment. And explain to them why they are experiencing these symptoms, how does the memory work, and then taking the next steps to increase their confidence, to try out their brain again, And if needed, we can also provide them some techniques. For example, I sometimes encourage, not always, but I sometimes encourage the patients to use mnemonics, practice active listening. For example, some minor strategies such as using cueing first word of a sentence to retrieve words. And sometimes just even taking breaks, managing their distractions, managing the pressures in their life, trying to reduce the autonomic hyperarousal they usually have, and being slightly more flexible about experiencing memory lapses, and showing them that everyone experiences memory lapses at some point. And sometimes the solution that they have adopted, so avoiding things and taking a lot of lists, became the problem on the long term. So we try to reduce these factors that are increasing the problem. And I think another point, I don't know if I emphasized enough, is of course treating the comorbidities. So if there are any comorbidities such as mood disorders, anxiety, sleep disorders, treating those obviously can improve cognition in the long term.
Okay. Thank you very much, Veronica. I think this was very interesting topic to discuss, and I hope that our listener also will enjoy.
Thank you.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.